I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guests are Zen Hospice Project Senior Director B.J. Miller, journalist John Mualim, and Stanford physician Lucy Kalanithi. Tonight's program is about a subject that, although universally shared, isn't easily embraced: how we as a society deal with the end of life. To inspire our collective awareness and conversation about dying, we've brought together some people who have thought deeply about how to create a dignified, graceful end of life. In 1990, while an undergraduate at Princeton, B.J. Miller was out late with some friends and decided, for the fun of it, to climb atop an electric train car. The electrical current arced from a piece of equipment into his wristwatch, sending 11,000 volts through his arm and out his feet, nearly killing him. His recovery was long and difficult, but the injury intensified his intellectual curiosity about death and suffering. Today, B.J. Miller is the senior director and advocate of San Francisco's Zen Hospice Project, which since 1987 has quietly helped pioneer the field of palliative care. He is also an attending specialist for the Symptom Management Service of the UCSF Helen Diller Comprehensive Cancer Center, one of the country's first outpatient palliative care clinics. His 2015 TED Talk, What Really Matters at the End of Life, crossed 1 million views within 2 weeks of posting to TED.com. Lucy Kalanithi is the widow of the late Dr. Paul Kalanithi, a neurosurgeon at Stanford who died of metastatic lung cancer last March at the age of 37. He left behind a manuscript describing his transformation from a medical student to a doctor to a patient to a new father confronting his own mortality. Lucy shepherded that manuscript to publication. The resulting book, When Breath Becomes Air, became an international bestseller. Lucy Kalanithi is an internal medicine physician and faculty member at the Stanford School of Medicine. Her interests include healthcare value, patient-centered care, and end-of-life care. Her primary interest is her almost two-year-old daughter, Elizabeth Cady. John Mualim is a New York Times contributing writer and author of Wild Ones. We'll hear first from Lucy. Then BJ and John will appear in conversation. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Lucy Kalanithi to the JCCSF.
Good evening. I'm so glad to join you tonight as we talk about making sense of our mortality, as we acknowledge that death is not a medical event, but a universally shared experience, a part of what it means to be human, a part of life. As we move into the program, I'd like to briefly tell you about two analogies, one about Zen Hospice Project and one about my late husband's book, When Breath Becomes Air, and reflect on what those two analogies mean for our discussion tonight. The first was written by John Mualim. John spent some time embedded at Zen Hospice, and he learned that at their hospice guest house, they humanize death, they treat it less medically and more compassionately, and they help their residents face death on their own terms. And when he wrote an essay called Death Redesigned for California Sunday Magazine, John said that Zen Hospice Project is a model for improving end-of-life care, and he wrote this. It's a clumsy analogy, maybe, but it was easy to imagine Zen Hospice as a kind of Chez Panisse of death, and B.J. Miller as death's Alice Waters. Now, as many of you know, Chez Panisse is a famous restaurant nearby in Berkeley that gave birth to California cuisine. And in the early 1970s, at a time when restaurant food was becoming more and more a spectacle and Michelin stars were being awarded only to the chefs who made the most complicated, elaborate recipes, Chez Panisse instead did something revolutionary. They went back to basics. They served local organic produce, and they became world famous for simple recipes that showcased the exquisiteness of eating natural natural seasonal food. And John Mualim noticed that Zen Hospice Project thinks about death in the same way that Chez Panisse thinks about food. His analogy resurfaced for me a memory of my late husband, Paul. It reminded me of something Paul said in the spring of 2014, after he'd been diagnosed with terminal lung cancer and just as he'd started writing his memoir, When Breath Becomes Air, about what it felt like to be a young neurosurgeon who was dying, who was seeing death from the perspective of both a physician and a terminally ill man. And I was sitting next to him soon after he started writing, and he turned to me and he said, you know, what I really want to do with this book is to do for dying what Annie Dillard did for nature. In her book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, Annie Dillard does a close observation of nature. She takes a slow, mindful walk in the woods, and she writes it down. Her readers found that their own experience of nature changed after reading the book. They themselves became more aware of the world around them, the savageness of nature, and the wonder of nature. So to reflect on those analogies, when Chez Panisse brought our attention to a season's bounty of food, and when Annie Dillard wrote about nature, they each uncovered something that was omnipresent, but at the same time somehow hidden, and they helped to refocus our attention on what's actually happening around us. They did something simple and stunning. They brought into the light something we don't always choose to see, and it deepened and enriched our lives. Zen Hospice Project and When Breath Becomes Air both invite us to observe death in the same way, for what it is, no more, no less than a core part of being human and a chance for us to come together to find meaning. And we're here tonight to do that. In clinics and hospitals and living rooms around the country and here, many of us are choosing to talk about death, to be present in the face of our mortality, to make what is hidden visible and personal, to accept death rather than to avoid it, and in doing so, to take better care of each other and to live more fully. Please welcome John Mualim and BJ Miller.
Hey, BJ.
Oh, hey, John.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for being here with us. Well, and thank you to Lucy for a beautiful introduction. Let us hit the ground running here. Well, BJ, I think a place to start maybe to kind of lay a foundation for people who may not know a whole lot about you and in your work is just with palliative care. You're a palliative care doctor. You're increasingly becoming a kind of ambassador for the field. I think palliative care is something that we've all probably encountered, at least conceptually, and I know for me at least I had some misconceptions about it. Maybe you could explain what that term means to you.
Yeah, thank you. There's a huge need for this. Even those of us in the field have a struggle to define the darn thing. So thank you. It's sort of like a public service, because there's more help available to us than I think most of us realize within the healthcare system, and therefore a lot of suffering that's unnecessary. So palliative care is sort of, there are paragraphs of ways to describe it, but basically palliative care is an interdisciplinary pursuit of quality of life. Sometimes it'll be defined around suffering. It's the mitigation of suffering. But it's basically, that's it. A bunch of disciplines gathering around a patient and their family within the context of illness and trying to make life as good as can be.
And not just at the end of life.
No, thank you, thank you. So the typical conflation is that hospice equals palliative care. And those of us in the field, it's a problem for a number of reasons. Because people wait too long to invoke it. But then also, then who the heck, then palliative care becomes this symbolic animal, this beast, the grim reaper coming down the hall to see you, when in fact it's 180 degrees opposite. So there's no time frame on palliative care. Hospice is the end game of palliative care. So all hospice is palliative care, not all palliative care is hospice. You guys probably know, but since the 1980s, since the Medicare hospice benefit in 1982, that's what set down this sort of idea that hospice is relevant in the last 6 months of life, which is, by the way, completely arbitrary. There's no, you don't become a different person at 6 months. There's no switch that gets flipped. They had to draw the line somewhere, and that's where they drew it. And then the second piece is that you have to give up all sorts of other kinds of care to go on to hospice. That's how the authors made it pay for itself. And that's a real problem. So palliative care is not an insurance designation, and it is not limited in terms of time. So I'll see folks at clinic at UCSF who have, you know, years to live.
And when you're working with these people, I mean, I've actually been to your clinic and seen you with patients. It seems like there's a lot of what palliative care is operating on is a philosophical foundation or almost a existential foundation. So I'm curious sort of what drew you to that to that approach to medicine. Maybe you can talk about sort of your path. I think it
personally,
it sort of goes back to your accident, doesn't it?
Yeah, very much. I mean, so I got into medicine. I hadn't studied medicine as an undergraduate. I got into it as a way to use my experiences, basically, as a way to make sense of what had happened and to use this education that I had. So medicine lit up as a way to do that. And so I just sort of started down that path, and I thought I could drone on about this. But I mean, to get to your point, I was going to go into rehab medicine, work with other disabled people. I wasn't so interested in medical science as I was in having a bag of tricks to be of service. And so I figured, I would go into rehab medicine. That was the most direct thing for me. But fell out of love with it deep in med school for a number of reasons. But one is it was lacking this idea of the sort of philosophical side, the meaning-making side of illness and life. That seemed just tragically missing. Even the word rehab implies that your goal is to get back to where you were before something horrible happened. And most of us know that you can't go back. You know, so, I mean, you're set up to fail right out of the chutes. And not only you're set up to fail, well, then you're also missing out on all this sort of transformation potential. So that's where my head was, and anyway, I was going to drop medicine altogether because I just sort of fell out of love with the idea. Then stumbled into palliative care as an intern in Milwaukee, and I mean the basic gist there was, well, you know, here's a field, you know, oriented around suffering, around quality of life. These are extremely obviously subjective states. I can't take a test. I can't give you a blood test to see if you're suffering or not. And which is so wonderful in medicine because the rest, you know, medicine prizes objectivity and prizes the power of knowledge that the physician has, a sort of specialized accumulation of skills and thoughts. Well, this totally flips it on its side because I can't tell you if you're suffering. You have to tell me that. So it flips the power dynamic immediately. And it elevates the patient in a way just right out of the chutes, which I love and was immediately attracted to. And I mean, I think the idea that, you know, suffering as a human condition, so this is one of my favorite questions to answer. I think I can see well enough in here. So who in the audience hasn't suffered? Let me see if there's a single hand. Any hands? Nope. Right. Okay, so you have a field in palliative care that's directly relevant to your experience as a human being. It seems like that's a part of life. Medicine for the last 150 years has tried to sort of crowd it out and crowd death out. But I think we're kind of coming to terms with this sort of reconciliation that there's an insistence on suffering, there's an insistence on death. So we need to sort of reconcile all that. And here's a field that is hell-bent on doing exactly that.
Well, let's tease that apart a little bit, because you actually found yourself thinking a lot about after your accident. And I think that there's a way, which you just sort of alluded to, that we try to push it aside. We try to take, I think we do something similar to both, you know, people with disabilities, mm-hmm. but also, you know, the aging and dying, where it's almost like we can't contain that kind of suffering in our reality. Mm-hmm. So even the language of, you know, heroics of, oh, mm-hmm. such an inspiration, or they're fighting cancer, mm-hmm. you know, it tends to put a distance between us. And I know that's something that you kind of gave a lot of thought to when you suddenly were in that position. Yeah. I mean, did you see your suffering as, you know, special? Did you?
No, this was not a stage question, but this is a great question. In fact, the way through for me was insisting that it wasn't special. It's sort of seeing the variation on theme and allowing the uniqueness of the variation, but this was a theme. It was not a special club that you had to give up a body part to enter. This was just, as we just proved, right? We know in our hearts what it means to suffer. And by the way, I like to define that word because I don't know if it's easy to define. I mean, the way I think of that word is, it kind of gets at our identity, but I like to think of it as a gap. So there's the world you want, and then there's the world you have. And if those two things are, if there's a big gap between the two, you suffer. And also the reason I like that sort of description is it gives you your two ways out, really. One is, you know, and this gets at some of the potency of mindfulness and meditation and the Zen background at Zen Hospice, which is, you know, learn to really be with what is and quit trying to change it. Just, and that's really hard to do, by the way. But that's one way to extinguish suffering. And the other way would be to change the world. And, you know, that's also kind of tricky. But I think most of us probably try to do a little both, split the difference a little bit. So anyway, that's how I just define suffering. So two big things came out of sort of lessons learned. One is that to see the material world, the body, as this beautifully flawed, ephemeral thing that clearly now was. I mean, it was proven to me. Parts of the body had to die, and I get it. So, but then to appreciate, therefore, what it means to have a body, even for a short amount of time, those two are deeply related. So, but anyway, to see the body as raw material to work with, to play with, was one big lesson. Second big lesson was really this point, that there is special is a real problem. Special goes with charity and pity and otherizing and all the things we do to put a wedge between ourselves and somebody else. And it's really, we have such a funny dance around this. I mean, we like to be considered special, but a lot of special people I know are pretty dang miserable because it inserts this unnecessary wedge. And I could, and early on, as a newly disabled person, I was aware of how seductive it was. I was getting a lot of pity. I could park anywhere. I had this, you know, it was like there were some sweet side effects that went with it. So more than once, people would just come up and give me cash. I'm not kidding. It was very strange. And more than once, I accepted it, by the way, because clearly it was for their own benefit. But you pretty quickly are aware that what you're doing, you're being separated with that specialness. And so for my own sake, I had to realize a world view that I could fit into that would allow me to look at the truth of what I had going on, but to see it as, again, this variation on theme, and that I was no different from you stubbing your toe, really.
And does it go in the other direction, too? I mean, how far does that theme vary? I mean, can you then put that same thinking to your patients who are dealing with, you know, terminal illness and at the end of their lives?
Yeah, to a large degree. I think the trick is you have to reserve a little bit of room for that specialness or the uniqueness or pick your word. But it would be a shame if I were to say, oh, hey, I know what you're going through with your metastatic cancer. I've been there before. No way. You know, that would really undermine a therapeutic relationship. So that's a funny little dance. You have to acknowledge sort of both of it. And most of it is realizing that they have to come to that. You can't impose this worldview on someone. I'm very aware that my obvious, this stuff gets me a long way into the mix with people that otherwise has to be earned. I get to go quickly places with people because I think it's just because they can look at my body, it's an obvious disability, and they know I've been in the bed. They know I've been sick. And there's a camaraderie that comes from that. So,
I mean, it sounds like you're talking about, when you're talking about changing the world versus changing your approach to it or your condition, it seems like you're talking about a space between, you know, we're going to move through denial, you know, we're going to accept that it's happening, but we're not going to go right away to despair, mm-hmm. right? And I think this is a lot of what palliative care is trying to do with people at the end of their lives as well.
You're listening to Zen Hospice Project Senior Director B.J. Miller, journalist John Mualim, and Dr. Lucy Kalanithi on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I mean, how do you, as a as an actual clinician, you know, when you're in the room with someone, I mean, I can say that in theory, and it sounds beautiful and like a wonderful mm-hmm. aspiration, but I mean, God knows I'm too neurotic to think that way, you know, if God forbid I was in that situation. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, you know, what is in practically speaking, how does this play out for people over time?
Well, one, you just said it. I mean, over time, so time's a big piece of this puzzle. It's both the opportunity and the horror, the tick-tock of the clock. But it can steal the mind. It can steal the body in some ways. And it can flatten you, too. So, I mean, I think one thing to be really, really clear on, especially as we get into talk about design or the creative potential and all this, this is a really key point, is that we don't... The idea is to not... isolate or orphan the hard feelings, despair, anxiety, depression, whatever it is, fear. It's more, if we're trying to do away with anything, it's the shame and guilt that goes on top of it. Like, I see this happen to myself and others where you just not only have to deal with something not going right, but then you got to hate yourself on top of it because you're not meeting some standard or whatever.
What do you mean? What's an example?
Well, I mean, I think, just sticking with this sort of example of my own experience, you know, I don't exactly have the ideal body, right? I mean, the world isn't really made for, the built environment isn't necessarily made for someone in my shoes. So you have this constructed universe that sort of excludes you. And, you know, by the way, the Americans with Disabilities Act, that's 1990. This is not that long ago that I had a right at public transport or to be in the building or whatever else. So this is all very new. But you know that in medicine we do a disservice too by sort of pathologizing people, pathologizing things like suffering and dying, which as we know are the definition of normal because they happen to 100% of people. But we're not careful. Our constructs, our language, we send signals to people that they're just not welcome. They're not part of this club anymore. And that's a shame. I feel very lucky. I have a mother who's disabled. I have a family who's loving, and I didn't have to hate myself for very long in these shoes. And I had people who would kind of love me before I love myself again. And there was a lot to say about that. But I think it's also pretty normal to be ashamed of a body that doesn't look like someone says it should, or you don't feel like you should, or whatever else.
And that you include people, you know, at the end of life in that too, that sort of suffering, yeah.
Totally. I mean, certainly within the medical sphere, and we're getting a lot better, but this idea that we treat, I mean, as physicians, to kind of keep ourselves going, we have this extortion with ourselves to keep pushing against the odds. And the way we do that is it's very useful. It's that humans, we create enemies so that we have something to push against and punch and to rally our energies. And so medicine has done that by calling death the enemy. And that's what gets your... allows your physician to be up for 72 hours in the operating room or whatever else. I mean, it does, there's a benefit, but it comes at huge, huge cost. And if there's someone not at the end of that conversation saying, yeah, sure, we're going to go to war with your cancer, but who's not doing that with a wink and calling that a construct and reminding you somehow that the cancer is your cell, that it's in you, and someday that battle will be lost, so you don't have to feel like a loser on top of the other suffering that is endemic. So it's this kind of stuff that we project onto people with our language, with our constructs, and with our own discomfort.
And so what happens for people when they can find that sweet spot, when they can get the right perspective on, you know, the rest of their lives, however long it's going to be? What sort of possibilities does that open up? And what have you seen?
Humor. Humor's a big one. Thanks for laughing. Humor is huge. And I mean, anything, you know, just think about, I love thinking about this, of just sort of the order of, you know, animal, the animal kingdom. What do higher animals do when they feel safe? You know, you get playful.
Make babies.
You make babies. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sure. And that's a sort of its own kind of play, right? You get playful, you get frisky. So we do really cool things when we feel safe. And all sorts of things become possible. And you see that play out at places like Zen Hospice Project at the Guest House or Laguna Honda or at Home Hospice. It's not, you know, there are other places to get a hit of this. So, yeah. So if you can sort of shave off some of the shame and isolation that goes on top of the pile, you open up space. And in that space, you can fill it with sort of a creative enterprise. This is another thing to be careful of here, guys. I think I started to say this, which is we can't mandate, we can't project a certain type of death. I mean, a lot of us in the field have to watch it. Our bias would be, I want a peaceful death. I don't want to be clutching, you know, by my fingernails, etc. But you know what? Some people do. I have patients who want to go down swinging, and there's a pride in that. Their suffering is an honor to it for them. Mine is to not say, oh, that's no way to die. My job is really, anyone's job in palliative care is to listen really carefully, understand what the person wants, and align their goals with what's possible in the system. And otherwise, get out of the way. I mean, it's very much the job of an usher and an eye opener. And now I've gone astray on your question.
No, that's right? Okay. So is that, before you were talking about, you used the word transformation a while back. We're rewinding a bit now. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to bring that up because it sounds like this is maybe what you're talking about when people can get the right eyes on what's happening. Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean by transformation? I mean, it's a pretty heavy word.
It is, and I guess maybe it's too heavy. And again, the last thing we want to set up anyone who's actually doing the dying is that they're failing. You didn't have a transformational experience? you know... So it's really, really, really tricky. Again, ours is at the epi-meta level. We sort of fashion a space. We condition it for these things to play out optimally as they might and optimally in their terms. The rest you kind of let go of. As we know, family dynamics are brutal. And in the stress of illness, this idea that we're all going to come together and love each other and brother and sister are going to, you know, not necessarily. So again, our job is to hold that. On this transformation piece, I think for us, we have to, this is healthcare at large here. People come into the healthcare system for the most part because something's wrong. And the best you can do is make it less wrong, less horrible. You know, we talk about suffering. My job, first and foremost, is to help mitigate suffering. In other words, make life less hard. This transformational, this potential space, the trick is, I think, just to note it, to acknowledge it, to make space for it, and then let it go. But the idea would be that we get above the sort of waterline. It's not just sort of life less horrible, but we actually have at least the potential that we don't, presuppose it out, that there can be transformation. There can be this wonderment at the end of life, too. So we just want to make it possible, but not demand it.
Well, and so that sort of brings us to hospice, right? Because that is a hospice really is a space where that is being hopefully made possible. At least the opportunity is there for people to kind of find meaning in the experience of dying. So that, though, seems to be another word like palliative care that I think is sometimes misinterpreted. So maybe you can tell us about Zen Hospice, where you work, and sort of talk us through, what does it look like? What does it feel like there? Who's there? Give us sort of a sense of the place.
So, Zen Hospice Project has been around almost 30 years. It grew out of the HIV/AIDS crisis in the 80s, like a lot of incredible organizations in this town in particular. But, I mean, how many of you guys in the audience know of Zen Hospice or have had any... That's amazing.
Should we skip that one then?
Yeah, I think we could probably skip that question. I mean, that's amazing to see. We are a teeny little organization, and yet this place has somehow gathered... I don't know. I meet people all over the world who once volunteered at Zen Hospice. Right? It's amazing. But to answer the question, just to review, I mean, Zen Hospice Project is, first of all, in some ways, it's a place, which it is actually a space. But it's not just a space. It's an ethos where people are sort of washed in this ability to sit with suffering. And that sort of upends the shaming piece like we were talking about earlier. Just real quick, our work plays out at the guest house, our home, 6 beds in Hayes Valley. Also at Laguna Honda's hospice ward for the last 25 years, I think. Now the hospice and palliative care ward, 60 beds there. And then we have a large education program that's growing mightily right now. 1-day trainings, 2-day trainings, etc. Then we have a storytelling program. There's all sorts of cool things happening under that roof. It's an amazingly complicated little place. So that's sort of Zen Hospice in a nutshell. I mean, it's the idea that kind of lets get above, in medicine here, sort of the medical model or the social model. This is like, let's have let's have something that just is functional and responsive in real time. So it's this blended place. It's a sort of, you could say, spiritually driven from its Zen roots, but a lot of us who work there are not Buddhist, per se, so it's ecumenical. At its
so what root. Is the Zen piece? What's Zen about it?
Good question.
That was a very Zen answer.
That's why I was smiling. I've finally learned. I've been there 5.5 years. So, yeah. Yep.
All right. I'm going to go carry some water. And then
Chop some wood.
We really need to answer that question. I mean, there is a mindset. I mean, from the time that I've spent there, you know, as a journalist, it does seem like there's a subtle undercurrent of something happening there, an approach to death that you just don't see in the rest of American society, which I've heard you articulate as approaching towards rather than stepping away from.
Yeah.
Which, having been there, I found to be a pretty good way of putting it. But what does that mean? How does that play out?
Yeah, I mean, you think about anything that seems frightening. You know, I was thinking about skiing. You know, you're going down the hill and you lean back, you kind of fight it, you feel like that's where your safety is. I don't know. There are many probably analogies where it turns out the safest and most effective thing to do is actually lean into it. You know, lean down the hill if you're afraid to fall. It may seem paradoxical. And I guess that's sort of a part of the technique or technology in a place like Zen Hospice Project is that the place is cultivated to lean into hard stuff. And meditation is a technique to allow yourself to be with whatever it is, with what is, period. And not chase it away or dress it up and turn it into something else. So I think Zen Hospice Project, the Zen piece comes from this mindfulness, this meditation piece, this being with what is, and not trying to change the things that you may not even be able to change if you tried. And that opens up a great deal of peace for a lot of us. So that's sort of first and foremost. It is we're 501c3 secular organization by license, just FYI, but we grew out of the Zen Center and are sort of washed, especially in our volunteer program and education. We get at this sort of existential piece of the puzzle, the spiritual piece of the puzzle. And by the way, spirituality is a word that means different things to different people. So Zen Hospice, a few years ago, we took upon ourselves to define that word for ourselves so people knew what the heck they were joining. We basically came up with this idea that that spirituality was a response to it was to ephemeral, the changing nature of things, and that we were purposeful about creating and cultivating presence. You know, being in the moment, which is a really potent thing when you're running out of moments. So when the clock is ticking and there's not much time to plan a future or to deal with it, and you might not really even have a future, and you're yanked by memories of the past or whatever it is, it's extra hard perhaps to be in the moment. So this idea of presence is really powerful and takes cultivating. That's piece one about this idea of spirituality. And it takes care of the time piece. And the second piece is that we are, we're interrelated. That, to some, that may sound like a belief. And I think increasingly we're aware that that's just the way, whether it's through climate change or discovery of mirror neurons, or whatever you have to justify yourself to yourself, that we affect one another. It's just the nature of the beast, and we celebrate that. That's a beautiful thing to us. Anyway, the third piece, I think, which really, for me, separates spirituality from an existential thing, would be this idea that we embrace not knowing, which is a really powerful thing, especially in counterpoint to medicine and science, which sort of, labels it ignorance and crowds it out. There's a beautiful thing to mystery and not knowing. First of all, it takes the pressure off us to know everything and control everything, which is crazy. That's folly, right? So this embrace of mystery is a very powerful, powerful piece of what we mean about spirituality. So
one thing that I've been really surprised with in the time I've spent there we should say a lot of the staff is volunteers, and the volunteers are doing a lot of anything. You know, maybe they're sitting with someone for an hour and listening to stories about the person's life. Maybe they're watching TV in silence. Maybe they're going down to get some more toilet paper. Mm-hmm. They're doing all sorts of things around the house. And as I got to know some of the volunteers, the thing that really stuck with me was this sense of uplift that they tend to have at mm-hmm. the end of their shifts. I mean, you know, people say, "Oh, this is the greatest thing I do all week." You know, mm-hmm. it's totally selfish. You know, mm-hmm. or you know, and I think that I wouldn't necessarily expect that they would be, you know, immeasurably depressed mm-hmm. after 3 hours at the guest house, because then why would they keep coming? But I thought, at least, you know, this is very kind of noble, draining work. You know, at best, it's like a net neutral effect mm-hmm. on your emotional well-being, you know, and you maybe just go have a beer afterwards and try to shrug it off and get on with your life. but where does that uplift come from? I mean, what is that feeling that's happening there?
Well, I suppose if you ask any of our volunteers, nurses, anyone who works there, they'd probably get different answers to it. But I think it has something to do, and this is related to the mindfulness piece and the Zen piece, which is this self-other. You know, it turns out that there was a pretty porous line between each other. And there's something very poignant about being able to see yourself in others and them in you. And then it becomes a shared experience, truly shared experience. And there's a feeling that one gets. It doesn't necessarily happen in Zen. I mean, any of us, I'm sure, has that feeling. When you do something for others, you can feel what you're doing for yourself. So this idea of selfish versus selfless kind of falls away. That language doesn't really suit. It's sort of one and the same in some real ways. So that, I think, is really powerful. And feeling that on your shift, whether it's being a nurse or volunteer or down in the office, feeling that you're part of an apparatus that's devoted to that effect, you know, it's contagious. And we hear this phrase all the time. People walk in the guest house and first step in and say, you know, why did I wait so long to come here? You know, I knew this place was special right from the start. There's something about the vibe. And I think that's what gets at it.
So you're also, one of your interests also is, you know, design and aesthetics. You studied art history. I'm curious how that plays into either the space of Zen Hospice or sort of how you're approaching this kind of transformation you've been talking about. Because there is sort of an artistic way of thinking about all this, I think.
Yeah. For me, the words, you know, it's creative. You know, once you kind of reconcile that there are things out of your control and this body will go away and you can turn it into this raw material for meaning-making, for play, you know, the aesthetic world is a huge, I mean, so first of all, let's define it. I think that word is often conflated with beauty. And so, like aesthetic dentistry or something. That's one piece of it. But it really is, at its root, the aesthetic world, the aesthetic domain is the life of the senses. As we know, that's a way we understand ourselves to be alive at all, is when you feel something. And that's one of the reasons why it's so magical to have a body. And one of the best ways to take advantage of your body while you have it is to feel stuff. And so that's what the aesthetic world is anything you perceive. It can be beautiful, but it doesn't have to. It can be repulsive. But it's an experience of having a body. And it seems really poignant within healthcare as a sort of sneaky way to upload the arts, to upload philosophy into this mix. And also, it's a great relationship to time. I think there are two ways to sort of stop the clock, or the tyranny of it in your mind anyway. One is meditation, and I think the other is these aesthetic experiences where you're not really aware of time passing, because the defining characteristic is it's an immediate experience. The aesthetic experience is not on behalf of some future thing.
Give us an example. If I'm a resident at the guest house, I'm not going to necessarily be, you know, brought out to the redwoods mm-hmm. to, you know.
Well, right, that's it. I mean, one of the things is to sort of take it out of the museums and out of the rarefied places. I mean, you got to see, if you're into God, I mean, I can find God on Mount Everest. Like, much more interesting to find God in a strip mall in New Jersey, for example. It's got to be an everyday thing. You have to feel that. It has to be accessible. So, right, Muir Woods, it's pretty easy to get this sort of transcendental vibe. But it doesn't need to be. It can be, like we talk about it in hospitals, you talk about the smell of cookies. I mean, I think that's just, there's something really powerful about the smell of cookies. There's the beauty of the home, the old Victorian, it's itself. It's just a beautiful thing. And, you know, or it can be, one of my favorites is feeling air and sun on my skin. That's not a means to an end. That is an experience in of itself. It reminds me of art for art's sake. It is self-contained. It is good enough as it is. It's not leverage. It can be the experience of an opiate, feeling pain wash out of you. I mean, anything you feel, obnoxious or otherwise, is an aesthetic experience potentially, and therefore something you can design for and craft and play with.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features Zen Hospice Project Senior Director B.J. Miller, journalist John Mualim, and Dr. Lucy Kalanithi. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
You've talked a lot in the past about systems design, redesigning not just sort of our perception of death, but actually the way as a society that we're dealing with. So I'm curious to get into that a little bit. I mean, where are we right now? You know, why is it that everyone who would want to can't, you know, die in a place like Zen Hospice? What are the obstacles in pretty concrete terms?
A couple of thoughts on that. So one, funding. It's a boring answer, but it's just the truth. Their insurance does not cover residential care. So we don't see a drop of health insurance reimbursement. And it's not just Zen Hospice, it's Coming Home Hospice, any residential facility. Even if you were to get hospice in a nursing home, once you go on to hospice, you're on the hook to pay the room and board of the nursing home. So this is a big problem. Medicine healthcare has traditionally divided the social issues from the medical issues. This is a huge, I mean, in the body of a person, there's no teasing the social from the medical. I mean, if you go hang out at San Francisco General or Highland Hospital emergency room, there's no line for the medical issues versus the social issues. They're all in the same heap. But the system has a real failing there. So anyway, so one is funding and the policy that allows for funding. I think, and on that note, by the way, I think it's also worth noting that the system is not designed very well. It's really important. This is a very important point. One reason I think it's so important, so we can forgive our hapless doctors and nurses and others for laboring in a system that's not really designed for a lot of the stuff that happens in the building. You know, this basic idea of human-centric or patient-centric or person-centric design, that's real. It's not a buzz phrase, because what it has been since the mid-19th century is oriented around disease. So, you know, you feel that if you're in a hospital, you'll be processed, homogenized, given khaki food, put in a gown, and there's no real room for your individual expression. I mean, you can kind of squeeze it in there, but you're being processed, and there's some sense to that. And we even talk about this in medicine. This is famous. This is not novel to any of you. You guys would talk about the heart in room 3, or we label people by their organ or their disease. And so anyway, the whole system needs to be reoriented. Medicine needs to, I think, you guys tell me, medicine, I think, needs to be in service to humanity, not in service to itself. I mean, why do we care about advancing the science but for its effect on humanity? I mean, I don't pretend this makes me sound like I'm really well-read, and I'm not, but this idea, Gandhi had the 7 blunders of the world, and one of them was science without humanity, and I think we have come to that. So I think we need to be reminded that the system is on behalf of what? We have to re-answer that question. So, sorry for the detour, but that's to policy and the funding that flows from it. The second huge piece that gets pointed out in the book, being mortal, and in some ways when breath becomes air too, is the idea that the education system is not up to date. We don't...
Medical education.
Sorry. Yes, the medical and nursing as well, social work, chaplaincy, they're all really due for a refresh. Because we're not trained to have difficult conversations. We're not trained in existential philosophy. We're not trained in aesthetics. We're not trained in anything that helps cultivate wellness or well-being. That's not our point to date. That hasn't been. So the whole medical education system needs to be rethought to accommodate all the inevitabilities that we're talking about.
One word that's come up, I guess it hasn't come up tonight actually, but in our past conversations that's come up a lot is alienation. Mm-hmm. That I think you've said that a lot of what you see and the terror people feel at the end of their lives or when they're given a diagnosis and they're entering that phase is a feeling of alienation, a feeling of losing their place. I think I can imagine that. That feels like a real response to me. So that's not a question. I'm just pouring out my worry and emotions. I guess my question is, tell me it doesn't have to be that way.
It does not have to be that way.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that alienation, we talked a little bit about isolation, shame, guilt, the stuff we heap on, the unnecessary bits that we somehow just... we must love our miseries on some level. So we sure cling to them. I do too. So alienation, I mean, there's a lot to say about that. I mean, it kind of gets also about purpose. We see a lot of folks who are despairing with their disease because they've lost their purpose. Perhaps they can't work. Perhaps they can't be that person in their family structure anymore. Their identity is off. And very often people crash hard when they no longer have that sense of purpose. So one answer to your question, John, is that we as a society, we need to get a lot better at repurposing ourselves. You know, this idea of aging, I think we treat aging in this way that, you know, in this society, your greatest value, you're honored most when you're sort of peak production. And then the rest is sort of this denouement, kind of getting out of the way in a polite fashion and making room for the next person to reach their peak, whatever. What a silly thing, right? So we throw away all this wisdom that folks who have been on the planet for a while have. We haven't honored it. So this idea of repurposing ourselves, reapplying ourselves, is a huge piece of upending the alienation that people feel. I mean, on that point about purpose, too, I think this gets back to the aesthetic piece. Like, let's get better at making purpose and finding meaning for ourselves and making it, yes. And I think, personally, I'm all for purposelessness. Like, I hope to God when I'm, my eulogy, if anyone comes, I hope they're not just, like, rattling off things I did. You know, this is another thing that's really poignant about Zen, this idea of being versus doing. We don't really honor being, and we're not very good at it. You know, I will speak for myself. I mean, I can almost hear a vacuum when I'm not doing something.
I've been thinking about like 100 other things while you're talking. It's like, come on already, you know. Like,
sorry. Yeah, but if you were better at just being, John, then you would be, you know, there's a skill set to that. And so I'm all for meaninglessness. You know, let's make space for purpose. Again, this idea of sun on your face, what's the meaning of that? Playing with my dog? I don't know what the purpose of that is. Sure, you could relegate to exercise or something, but screw that. It's just fun. It's delightful. I love it. So purposelessness is another really big theme.
One really bizarre thing of talking to you about all this is how comfortable and... I'm not recoiling, you know, as like you have a way of talking about end of life and not just the end of life, but the sort of the meaning of life. I mean, that's really, you're circling around the meaning of life in a way that I think is somehow energizing for people. And I think the weird part of that is that, you know, all these people are going to leave, and if it's had the same effect on them, they're going to have this sort of energy, this sort of proactive energy to go and do what? Like go off and die? You know, it doesn't... So I feel like in very practical terms, it seems almost necessary to ask, you know, where does that put us? You know, say that we're all, you know, a little bit closer to making that kind of perceptual shift that we've been talking about. What do you do with that energy? Or what do you do with that energy since you've been steeped in this a lot longer?
Well, okay. Let's see here. Let me start with the sort of brass tacks because I often forget these pieces and they're really important. I mean, so bear with me, but there's a couple of things that we all know. I mean, we should all be doing our advanced directives. If you don't state your wishes, you're going to end up on some pathway that you didn't want to be on, okay? So if you really want medicine to reorient itself around what you care about, you got to articulate what you care about. And it's not just a boring advanced directive form. I mean, there are all sorts of... ethical wills and ways to create a legacy for yourself, or maybe to play with time, both you and Lucy and I were just talking from different angles about this. Like, you know, you can, the idea of avoid, like a life of a theme, an impulse to avoid regret. So I like, sometimes when I don't know what to do, I jump ahead and look back on the situation and say, how I wish to have handled it. And that's a fun, very helpful. So where was it? Living your life in a way so you don't pile up the regrets, which means usually checking yourself pretty frequently. Am I doing what I care about? If I died right now, you know, should I? Is there someone I need to say I'm sorry to or I love, etc.? So that good work. And funnel that in as part of your sort of advanced care planning. And that's not one conversation. You have that conversation over and over again because we change our minds. This is a dynamic thing. So that's one big piece. Another big piece is really, guys, Zen Hospice, we need your support, absolutely. But, you know, there are others too. Other hospice agencies, hospice organizations, palliative care programs. None of these things is, for the most part, robust enough from just billing to make a go of it. We need sort of financial support. We also need moral support. You know, just talk about this. You're doing the world a favor by piercing this veil, taking it out of the closet. You know, another thing, so yeah, your support at Zen Hospice would mean a lot to us. And if you don't hear, support a program that you love elsewhere. A third piece, which is this policy thing. I mean, this idea in the field, a lot of folks ahead of us in the field would say, you know, we don't want to stoke demand, because if we stoke demand for these services, the system can't handle those services and will implode. Well, screw that. I think this conversation is on behalf of this idea that, we, the people, need to sort of push this. This idea that dying should be something that any community should be proud of how they handle. This would be part of our civic identity, how we age and how we die. So that means talking about it, delighting in it, and when you're suffering or when someone around you is, leaning into them instead of running away. That work's very important. Then finally, this policy piece, huge. So there is, if you go to our website, zenhospice.org, there is a button, a support button, that'll link you. We have a shared site with the Hospice Action Network, which has some policy briefs around education and training in the healthcare world, around opening the hospice benefit so you don't have to give up certain things to go on to hospice, etc. So there are things you can check out on the policy front there, and, you know, lobby your local congressperson. So that's a good list. I think otherwise, man, I mean, the most durable thing I've ever seen in my experience, if you want to prepare yourself for dying, gets back to this avoiding regret. Like, live your life.
How do you deal with that?
How do I do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're giving off an impression that you're just like, my life's, you know, no regrets.
I mean, thanks for busting my chops on that, because honestly... No, I mean, a lot of what I'm saying here is aspirational. I hope I'm listening to myself too, truly. So this is why we call this stuff a practice. This is a daily grind. You know, you wake up. I notice my first thoughts, the first half hour of my day, is spent on all of the things I think I screwed up or regret. That's where I start every friggin' morning. So anyway, I got a lot of work to do, but I do think, I mean, thanks to my injuries, thanks to this work, thanks to the peers and colleagues I have in this field and friends I have in this world, we all keep, you know, the great thing is we don't have to invent, you don't have to lop off a limb, and you don't have to invent some dramatic suffering. It's coming your way no matter what. So so don't have to plan for it. You don't have to, like, cultivate it. It's coming. And when it comes, deal with it. You know, and when something is there to savor, really savor it. Sometimes I, as a kid who grew up sort of privileged and education, you know, white suburbia, you know, my penance was to not enjoy the privilege. It didn't serve anybody, you know. So anyway, savor things. That, I swear to you, living your life as best you can is the best thing you can do to prepare yourself to die.
All right, we'll end there and we'll take... Oh. So Lucy's gonna come back, and we'll take questions for BJ or Lucy. Right.
So questions for BJ, for Lucy, for John.
Yeah, thank you. I feel like your conversation is just making this room feel so much smaller and so much more intimate. So thank you. I was wondering if you could talk a little more specifically about the turning point or the process of coming to terms with one's death, and from your experience, what what has specifically most helped or supported that process?
I can start. I think I really like something that that BJ said and that I know my husband Paul wrote about and talked about, which is they're sort of not dying and living as separate things. We're sort of doing both of them all the time, including we're living when we're dying. And I think so having an understanding of that, I think, is sort of, it sounds so simple, but if you can really get your head around that, it's a big deal. And I think there was something that happened, when Paul was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and he was young, he was 36 when he was diagnosed, both of us had seen that bad things happen to people, that we'd both treated many patients in very difficult situations with brain tumors or terminal illnesses or very ill children. And I think sort of acknowledging that suffering is around us and our bodies fail and our bodies die, and sort of being open to witnessing that and accepting that and sort of joining together and not pushing that aside, I think it sort of helped that we'd seen it more than we might have expected at a young age. But I don't know, that sort of helped us to be not bitter or angry. And instead, we had really strong feelings. We felt sad. We felt anxious. But we didn't have the same pushing back against what was happening because we realized it could happen to anyone and it was happening to us. So I don't know.
Yeah, I think we're going to, I think this in a way will get easier as a society just by the sheer volume of people living with chronic illnesses, living with the thing, the diagnosis that will one day kill them. The huge preponderance of us who will be involved in either the care of ourselves or others with chronic illness, death, we're in for this next, I don't know how many, 30, 40 plus years as we watch the sort of baby boomer generation play out and just the aging population sort of wave play out. This is inherently going to become less exotic. This conversation will be like, duh, you know, a couple years from now. You know, so one is just, it's coming. And just by virtue of familiarity, we will have practice in a way. And you can start your practice now by just thinking of just treating every loss as a little bit of a death, a little mini death. Give it a little grief, give it some potency, turn your attention to it, honor it, ritualize it if you want, and move on. So, I mean, I think there's a million ways to practice this. Tibetan Buddhism, I mean, this is not new stuff. So I guess that's my answer to your question is, A, it's going to get easier, I think, for us as a society, and I think for us as individuals, let's just get in the habit of pulling our loss out of the closet and just see what the magic of that alone, I think, will take us far.
Thanks so much to all of you. This has been truly an extraordinary evening. Thank you for being here. Thank you, Lucy, John, BJ.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were Zen Hospice Project Senior Director B.J. Miller, journalist John Mualim, and Dr. Lucy Kalanithi. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espolay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.